Ladies and gentlemen, everything is recording and audio is passing through. Mr. Chair, the floor is yours.
Thank you. So good morning, everyone. I'm Jean-Pierre Wolf, your chair. Welcome to our Friday 17, 2020 Regional Water Quality Control Board. And it is 9:01 a.m. And before we start the meeting, I would like to read a brief statement in regard to this remote meeting protocol. Is that we are online as a meeting due to COVID-19 pandemic. And in order to comply with public gathering limitation and physical distancing requirements, and as authorized by the governor executive order, there is no physical meeting room, and this meeting is being conducted entirely by remote online access. Please be patient. We need to be more methodical about how we run remote virtual meetings. And we are receiving presentations and public comments through the Zoom webinar platform. The Zoom meeting link has been made available to the public via our agenda link. And for people who only want to watch and listen to the meeting, the Water Board customary webcast is also available. If you're a presenter or intend to comment, you should already be in the Zoom webinar as an attendee using the meeting link provided on the board's website and should have submitted a virtual speaker card online in a request form. If you have not already submitted an online request form, you can access it via the remote meeting link at the top of our line meeting agenda or by contacting our clerk of the board or clerk of the board at rb3-commentletters@waterboards.ca.gov, including speaker comment in the subject line. Presenters and speakers will be on mute with your camera turned off until it is your turn to speak. The meeting host will then unmute you and ask you to turn on your camera if you have one. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute and camera turned off, and you can remain in the Zoom webinar until the completion of your item, and then you may choose to exit the webinar, continue with Zoom, or follow the webcast. This meeting is being webcasted and recorded, so please speak slowly and clearly. So thank you very much. And probably after six more Zoom, I'll have this memorized by heart. So thank you for your patience. And I would like to start with roll call, please.
Dr. Wolf.
Present.
Ms. Gray.
Present.
Dr. Hunter.
Here.
Mr. Johnson.
Here.
Mr. Young.
Here.
Thank you.
All right, so thank you. So the next item will be a public forum. So I do believe we do have one speaker card.
Jean-Pierre, should we do introductions first?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all.
Yeah, so I'll do the introductions and then one kind of logistical update. So starting with clerk to our board, Tammy Olson. There we go. Thank you. And our Water Board Legal Counsel, Stephanie Yu.
Good morning.
Morning. Our Assistant Executive Officer, Taya Tryon.
Good morning.
Morning. And now our Section Manager is starting with Harvey Packard, who's also our Zoom Coordinator for our meeting today. Thank you, Harvey.
Hello.
Morning. Angela Schroeder.
Morning.
Morning. And Chris Rose, last one.
Good morning, everybody.
Yeah, I'd also like to acknowledge some of our staff today that are helping us with our IT support for our Zoom meeting, and the Aaron Katona. And see him. Well, I know he's lurking in the background there somewhere. And Katie DeSimone. So thank you for your additional support today and helping us run our meeting smoothly. And also just a reminder announcement again that we've removed item 14 from our agenda today, and that's for the proposed basin plan amendment to revise and clarify waste discharge prohibition language. And we'll be bringing that back to the board at a later date. So in case people in the public out there are expecting that item today, just wanted to give you a heads up that it has been pulled from our agenda. So with that, thank you very much. Jean-Pierre, you can take it away for public comment.
All right, thank you. And before we take on the next item, yesterday, Dr. Hunter had a nice, good suggestion to ask how many participants it looks like we're having today. So could we have a update number? All right, maybe we can get that information a little bit later. So without further ado, I would like to move to public forum item 11. I believe it is Ms. Kay Mercer. 3 minutes, please. So let's coordinate the clock.
Hello, can you hear me? Can you see me? You can?
We cannot see you, Kay. We can hear
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I lost the Zoom broke. I lost connection just as I was to speak. But that's okay. I can speak without you seeing me and preferred anyway. So I'm Kay Mercer, and I'm coming before you as a citizen of Paso Robles. Thank you for allowing me to make comment on the Paso Robles fires. I sent a letter and some photos late yesterday. I apologize for the late submission, but you may not have had a chance to read them, so hopefully you can after my comments. I want to thank you for working with the city to begin clearing in the river and under the temporary emergency permit. I was one of the evacuees during the fire on June 22nd, and my understanding is over 6,000 people received an evacuation notice. So that's roughly 25% of the city was either notified of impending evacuation or had to evacuate. I come to you to ask you to continue to work in good faith and to work expeditiously on a long-term plan. I know the city has already submitted a draft for the long-term plan to the staff. Our concerns are that the negotiations of the long-term plan will get protracted among the many agencies, and then each year that the plan is not approved, we'll be coming to you for an emergency plan after property is lost or there's a major fire. I do have some recommendations. I hope the plan does consider spring prescribed burns. In the research that I did for my letter for 4.0, prescribed burns are going to be critical for managing the river. I hope you consider bringing in some other groups to help facilitate or act as a liaison. My suggestion would be either Creeklands Conservation, Steph Wald is great to work with, or the Central Coast Wetlands Group, and that would be Ross Clark. I know that the stream maintenance program up in Salinas and in Monterey County, they had to bring in the Nature Conservancy. So I would also suggest that you look at Atascadero for maybe a model. The De Anza Trail and the Atascadero Water District are both managed very differently than the river in Paso Robles. I've had the opportunity to walk the De Anza Trail there and have also walked on the Water District's land, and it looks very, very different than Paso Robles, and there's a question as to why. And then I have to put in a plug for the stream maintenance program in Monterey. Their permit comes due in about a year. I hope that the renegotiations are a little bit more rapid and easier than previously. And I would like to see it expanded to the include banks and levees in Monterey County. Right now, that is only for secondary channels in the river, and we have a major mess on the banks. Thank you.
So, Ms. Mercer, thank you for your comment. And on this item, yesterday, as part of my chair's report, I gave actually a fairly detailed update on this particular item. And, you know, certainly one, I know you had contacted me by phone shortly after the fires, and I shared with you my total understanding of your concerns and trepidation associated with being a block and a half from the fire, having myself experienced a few years ago a creek fire on my property, which got out of control. So, you know, I certainly understand the seriousness of the situation. I had committed to you by phone to become personally engaged, and as such, on the 9th of this month, so just about a week ago, had a face-to-face meeting at the burnt areas with Assemblyman Cunningham, the mayor, chief of the fire department, assistant chief, the Paso Robles police, public works, social service, and walked through the area which burnt, walked through areas of homeless encampment. And since then, we have taken a very expedited approach for the emergency permit, extended also the period allowable for the vegetation management, and concurrently are working on the long-term permit. I would point out also that already the Upper Salinas Tablas RCD is engaged in this project. You mentioned Creekland and other agencies, but already the RCD is on board. So rest assured that everything, all the gears are moving, and the meeting was extremely collaborative with emphasis on expediency for the addressing the fires. And as you well know, since you and I spoke, and actually since this meeting took place, there has been several more fires taking place. So we understand the criticality. So thank you for bringing that issue to us. And that's also my little update for you. Thank you. So at this time, do we have any additional public comment? I don't think so, but I'm sure.
Mr. Chair, this is Bob Loy with AGP Video. I apologize. I was monitoring the broadcast when you asked how many viewers we had actually on. We have 15 on right now, but we wanted to update you on yesterday's meeting. We had 80 viewers coming in and actually watching the meeting through through the process of the day. So I apologize. I missed that request or question, and you have to speak.
No problem. Thank you. And I would like just for staff and perhaps Tammy, you could keep track of that. Just keeping tab of, you know, participants at these Zoom meetings. I think since we're meeting virtually, it's hard to see how many people are in the room. So I would appreciate if we do that.
I will send an email to the staff to for every meeting that we do from now on.
Thank you. Matt, did you raise your hand?
Yeah, I did. Thank you, Bob. That was going to be my ask, if you wouldn't mind tabulating that in an email to our staff. And if you would also make a distinction, or can you make a distinction between the Zoom participants and those that may be watching the webcast?
I do see numbers in relationship to both of those processes. I don't know how many attendees that are involved in the Zoom meeting are actually watching the webcast at the same time. So that could skew the numbers in essence. So, but I will do my very best to see if I can filter it as clear as possible.
Thank you.
Okay. So thank you.
Excuse me, Michael has his hand up.
I just turned my eyes toward my second screen, and I just saw Mike waving. Thank you. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. Following up on Ms. Mercer's comments, I would be curious to get an update down the road as to where we are on working out that long-term permit. And I'm particularly curious about the springtime controlled burn question, and whether that turns out to be a productive means of vegetation control. mimicking natural watershed processes. So I certainly don't want to give any direction to staff as an individual, but I would appreciate, personally, I'd appreciate hearing back a progress report down the road on the permit.
Yeah, and just for your info, Mike, CalFAR particularly has been very much engaged in the area of control burns, you know, particularly about the responsibilities with forestry, where here in Paso, it is actually the Paso Fire Department which manages the clearing of overgrown shrubberies, trees, and in vegetation. But yes, I'm sure that's going to be part of the total picture, and we'll make that an action item to follow up and getting a brief update as part of the EO report. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm particularly interested because I'm not aware that in any of the stream bed stuff that we've worked on, I haven't heard of any controlled burn stuff. And if it does turn out to be a useful tool, it may be applicable elsewhere. So I'm pretty curious about it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Next item is going to be item 12, enforcement. And Matt, could you introduce that item?
Yes, thank you. So the enforcement report.
Monica has her hand up.
Yeah, excuse me. I'm sorry, Jean-Pierre, if I could just add on one final comment. I just wanted to thank Kay Mercer for providing a series of photos that were sent out as part of her email communication. I had a chance to look through them. They're pretty informative. And Jean-Pierre, to your point of being able to go out there and take a look at the burn areas and also to understand the relationship between the thick brushy areas and the homeless encampments. Some of that comes across as well as the vandalism. I had a role in funding and bringing that river walkway project to the city of Paso Robles back in 2007, and it was a community project with multiple benefits, including riparian restoration. So it is unfortunate to see that there is some management issues going on across the board. In addition to the safety and fire threat, there's just been personal safety for people wanting to be down in that area, walking through that river walkway area. So thank you, Kay, for providing us more information. It sounds as though between the different authorities and jurisdictions, the right people are sitting down together and taking a look at the whole situation. And of course, the fire threat is the priority, but the homeless encampments and looking for solutions that will be a community effort, perhaps is going to, move the needle on several different problems at once. So thank you again for helping us to get more detail on that.
Thank you. So Matt.
All right. Thank you. So item number 12 is our enforcement report. And unlike our roughly annual enforcement program updates where staff gives a formal presentation providing more detail regarding our enforcement priorities and efforts, this is one of our routine quarterly enforcement report updates. And in particular, this update summarizes the enforcement actions taken from January 16th of this year through April 30th of this year. And it consists of a number of tables. Tables 1 through 4 include summaries of issued final administrative civil liability orders, expedited payment program letters to resolve mandatory minimum penalties, and other non-controversial violations. Also includes cleanup and abatement orders and notices of violation covering our various programs. Otea Tryon, our assistant executive officer, is available this morning to answer any questions you may have regarding our enforcement report.
Yes, Mr. Young.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Taya, could you provide any additional information on the City of Santa Barbara's El Estero wastewater plant violations?
Which table are you referring to?
It's table 2 on page 4 of your report.
Oh, these are minimum mandatory penalties that we issue for violations of effluent violations. There were some issues with pH and ammonia, but they have been resolved, and we do have to issue the MMPs, though, in order to resolve those.
Any idea what caused that series of upsets?
I'd have to ask Harvey to chime in, as he's the lead for the MPDS permit group.
Good morning, Harvey Packard here. Sorry, Jeff, I don't have any detailed information on these, though we could look it up and get back to you if you'd like.
That would be fine. Thank you very much.
All right.
Yes, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. I would just like to hear a little bit more about the cannabis cultivation situation. It appears we have quite a few failing to submit reports, technical reports, and some other problems. What do we know about? Are we able to do site inspections right now, given COVID, and how are we managing these problems?
I figured there were going to be some questions about the notices of violations, because there are quite numerous number of violations for cannabis. So I'm happy that Arwen is here. She's program manager for the cannabis program.
Hi, Arwen.
Morning. Arwen Whitemeyer, cannabis program manager. Nice to see you all. So just to provide you a little bit more information, Dr. Hunter, about the cannabis violations that you see. So in March 1st was the annual reporting due date. And, you know, as usual, not everybody submitted the report the first time around. I do want to say we held an annual reporting workshop a couple months prior, and it went really well, and we were able to record it and post it. This was before all this COVID stuff happened, but we were able to record it, post it. It was well attended. So we actually had, we held that in San Luis Obispo, and we actually had really good submittal rates in Slo County. So it worked really well there. This was the first time we have done that. We hope to expand that to other areas throughout the region in the future, because we think that it helped a lot. You know, we had overall a good compliance rate. We send reminders before the due date. We send reminder emails after the due date. Some people just need additional prompting, and that's where the NOV comes in. So we send a notice of violation that typically we get about a 50% return on those NOVs that we send out, where about half of the people will actually then submit the report. So, you know, it's kind of business as usual, I would say, in terms of those, the annual report submittals. You also asked about inspections. So right now we're not performing inspections. Previously in the past couple months, it's been a little, I'll say, tighter in terms of let's not perform inspections. We don't have protocols in place. We want to make sure that staff are safe, everything like that. We're starting to be able to, we've developed inspections protocols. We're starting to be able to go out on inspections, but we haven't scheduled any yet in our region. I don't think the other regional boards are performing them right now either.
Right, right. And just so I'm a little more, have a better picture of how the cannabis group operates. Do they have their own network or newsletters, or do they, or are they organized into a group as operators?
Some are. There is, I don't recall the name of the group, but there is a group in like the Santa Barbara area in general that kind of a coalition of sorts of growers. I don't know that they provide much assistance in terms of our reporting or our requirements, but you know, they're probably helping them navigate through all of the regulatory hoops that cannabis growers have to deal with. And there are a lot of them.
It seems like it's growing all the time. And then do they have a particular a particular lane in terms of technical assistance, and are there technical providers that are working with them?
Yeah, there are quite a few technical assistance providers. I don't have a sense for the exact numbers in our region of people who use technical assistance providers versus people who don't, but I do know that a lot of them do. My staff interact with technical assistance providers that are helping out many operations throughout the region. You know, some of the providers we see their names popping up a lot.
Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm guessing that's another conduit to convey information about not only the workshops, but also in terms of the requirements and how to get informed and all of the plugging them in, you know, to websites and so forth. There, you're using the technical providers as well to get that information out.
Yeah, we're definitely leveraging them. We also have been working hard to develop relationships with county staff and RCD staff, certainly Fish and Wildlife and CDFA, Cal Cannabis staff, you know, all the other agencies who we work with who have various levels of field presence. And we want to make sure they're also aware of our requirements so that, like, when RCDs are out helping cultivators work on their site, they're aware of our setback requirements and what that means. And so, you know, making sure that the cultivators aren't setting up their site within the setback, things like that. So we're working closely with a lot of agencies.
Yeah, I recall that some of the early problems that we saw occurring in high numbers was that the setbacks and actually setting up operations in dry creek beds and so forth. So I don't know how that appears to you now, given the pause of field inspections and all of that, but it will be something we want to hear back from as far as progress with the problems and getting them better informed. So
yeah.
Look forward to that.
If I may supplement Erwin's answers, Dr. Hunter, one of your questions was, do cannabis growers have association or trade organization? The answer is definitely. Although I would say, at least from my observation, most of them are more focused on the advocacy side of support of that industry. But in terms of technical service providers, actually the RCDs have held workshops for cannabis growers and also hemp growers. The Coastal RCD, Upper Saline, Tablas, Kachuma RCDs, all of them have had workshops, which basically dovetails the requirements of our water board and then assist them in compliance through the various practices that are required. So that has taken place. Also, because of some of the plant pathology similarities between hemp and cannabis, a lot of the technical service providers basically work on both sides, on the cannabis side and on the hemp side. You know, they regulate it differently, but, you know, obviously it is well known, you know, there's a lot of similarity in the plant behavior, etc. So that's to help augment a little bit the information for you, Dr. Hunter. A question that I have that ties to cannabis is, we have a report here, Chaya, of legal growth, but it is well known that, you know, we have also still illegal growth. And we're talking here about the regulated community, but what's the update on the legal growth in terms of, you know, stats within the entire Central Coast region, keeping in mind that since we have the largest amount of permits of any region in the state of California, I would draw a little bit of a dotted line that, you know, if this area is very attractive for legal growth, I don't think it's mutually exclusive that we, you know, we don't have illegal growth. So I think it would be valuable to get an understanding of what's taking place. I know this tends to be more this is in the hands of enforcement, but, you know, State Water Board has the enforcement arm. So I would like to get those kind of updates too, because the whole idea ultimately is to move the needle from an underground, agriculture operation to legal operation. And so do you have any updates for us on that, Taya?
This is Matt. This might be a good time for me to chime in and provide you with kind of a general budget and a staff resource update. And as it relates to identification and enforcement against illegal cannabis operations in our region. So as I think many of you may already be aware, there's been a budget shortfall between our staffing resources and the permit fees that support those staffing resources for the last couple of years. There's been ongoing discussions in Sacramento regarding various ways to bridge that budget shortfall with either fee changes, budget change proposals approved by the legislature, the governor's office, to make up that imbalance. In response to the COVID-related kind of economic downturn we're facing, that really brought this issue home. And so just in the last several weeks, the decision was made that there's not going to be any fee increases. The legislature has not put forth legislation and funding to make up that shortfall to, you know, help support our staffing resources. So the program statewide is currently subject to a 50% cut in staffing resources across the region associated with this. And our relative portion of that cut is taking us from a initial total of 8 staff for our cannabis program in Region 3 down to 3 staff. So currently we have 5 staff and 3 vacancies for the cannabis program. We're going to lose those three vacancies, and we're being asked to redirect 2 of our cannabis program staff to different programs. So we're now going to have to manage our cannabis workload in our region with 3 staff, and that includes Arwen, our program manager. Along with this is a directive to have more of a priority focus on the identification and enforcement against illegal cannabis growers, with the intent of getting them enrolled in our permit to try to get our permit fee revenues back up. So we are kind of shifting our focus. We're going to be in the process of more focused identification of illegal grows in our region. We currently do have a general understanding of where some of these are, but the data that it's used to generate the number of illegal grows is still a little bit fuzzy statewide as well as within our region. Particularly with respect to identifying illegal grows that are within existing agricultural areas, because it's kind of difficult to differentiate between traditional agriculture and cannabis grows. Also, you know, within hoop houses, it's hard to identify, and indoor grows as well are very difficult to pinpoint. So this is something that's going to be an ongoing focus of our efforts moving forward relative to this revised statewide approach associated with very significant cutbacks in our staffing resources moving forward.
So Matt, when State Water Board rolled out the cannabis division and also the cannabis division for the regions. On a state level, there was a strong support to identify illegal growth. So it was basically not expecting regions and not expecting Tay or Irwin to go around and sniff around for illegal growth. Okay, so that's what's done through other parts of the state agencies who are more on the law enforcement side, you know, collaboration with sheriffs, use of helicopters, aerial mapping, surveys, etc. And in fact, as you recall, when we had a couple of years ago cannabis updates, they were actually, you know, showing aerial photography, utilizing infrared imaging to be able to differentiate color spectrum associated with cannabis, at least the open air ones versus other crops. So I guess where I'm asking my question here is that, you know, staff reduction predominantly impacts regulating the legal growth. Not that, you know, we're the ones, like I said, you know, trying to sniff out the illegal growth. So to your knowledge, where does the state stand? Because, you know, this is collaborative effort. We don't have trespassing rights.
Yeah.
And to be blunt about it, in terms of safety, there's good reason why quite often, you know, fish and wildlife was utilized in NOAA, because these folks also they are legally allowed trespassing, and also, you know, they do have means of discouraging bad actors, because they, you know, when fish and wildlife shows up, they have a few tools in their truck to discourage illegal growers from, you know, retaliating. So where does that stand, to your knowledge?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Moving forward with respect to, you know, identifying and enforcing against illegal grows is going to take a significant coordinated statewide effort. And that's part of the approach. And we'll be looking to our state water board counterparts to help us with that, along with fish and wildlife and other local law enforcement agencies. And then you also brought up a very salient point as well, and one that I meant to mention, you know, as part of my previous update, is that what this really does more than anything else is it limits our ability to engage at the same level for compliance assistance with our legally enrolled growers. And so that's going to be a difficult balance to strike. But moving forward, definitely, it's going to take a lot more robust coordination regionally and statewide relative to identification and enforcement against the illegal grows. And that's the expectation, as I understand it, from Sacramento, and this goes above and beyond State Water Board, is that there will be broader state agency coordination on this effort.
And to that point, Matt, streamlining the process, because it's not for the faint of heart right now to be a cannabis grower, because of all the layers of permits required, even within state board, where you get state board permits, you got to have regional board permits. And I think in one of the conversation you and I had, that was part of the plan also to try to streamline the permits to further encourage people moving into the, you know, the legal aspect of the growing cannabis, correct?
Oh, yes, definitely.
All right, so I'm looking at my screen. Yes, Mr. Young.
Question I see here in table two, no, in table four, all of the notices of violation are for Santa Barbara County. Were there none for the other counties, or are you parsing these out, the notices by county?
There's notices for Santa Cruz as well. There's just a preponderance of notices for Santa Barbara County.
Okay, so
I just keep going in the table.
And then Arlen, corroborate this. I think the largest footprint that we have is in Santa Barbara County, is it not?
Right.
By far.
Yes, definitely.
You're right.
And I'll just add that, you know, Santa Barbara has, I mean, if you're a grower, you're going to have whiplash in Santa Barbara County because the ordinance allowed one thing, then it was retracted. And so there's been a lot of changes over the past 2 years in terms of the allowance for cannabis, types of grows, types of permits required. While there's organization, I think to Jean-Pierre's point, there's a lot of advocacy, whether or not they're sharing information and how to come into compliance, I think is a completely different item altogether. And so with this evolving cannabis ordinance process, at least in Santa Barbara, it's extremely difficult for growers. And then there's a possibility for people to utilize that confusion to find their own way of doing things.
Yeah, to your point, Jane, Santa Barbara County, I believe, is a county in the state of California, has the highest density of permits of anywhere. So that tends to explain, too, why we have more report, issues in Santa Barbara County. And then also to your point, Jane, is that You have a grower, but it's one thing to grow, it's another one to sell the product. And then you get into the limitation at the city levels to have permits for dispensaries and also home deliveries. And that further limits the sales channel. And so that's an additional hurdle for some of the growers who have tried to be, I guess I'll use a vineyard term, appellation driven, and not necessarily having the proper channels to sell. So it's pretty complex in terms of, the whole value chain for cannabis, and that relates to the whiplash you were referring to also, Jane.
Well, it's not just the distribution, but it's the production and processing, right? So one thing to grow it, it's another thing to process it into various types of, edibles and other types of products. And so there's a lot of bottlenecking there as well. So you're correct that we are sort of ground zero in Santa Barbara County for permits. We're also ground zero for all kinds of growing. Those that are within the legal realm and those that are still operating not under any sort of permit. And I will say that I think there are probably three at best county planners that are processing the hundreds of permit applications within the county, all of which, most of which, if not all of which, are being appealed on an ongoing basis. So it creates a really difficult process.
Thank you.
We have Mike and Jeff.
So we haven't heard from Mike yet, so I'd like to give a priority to Mike and then Jeff after. Go ahead, Mike.
I think Monterey County, as I recall, is limiting, and I know City of Watsonville is as well, is limiting grows to indoor. So there is some stuff that doesn't show up on our radar, because it is it doesn't involve a discharge, but I guess my question was, I think in all of these counties, the county's getting tax revenue from legal grows, legal operations, and it seems like, and I'm assuming, Arwen, that this is kind of a priority of yours anyway, but it seems like building, it's not just the state helping us identify and deal with illegal grows, but it seems like the counties and where permitted the cities have a huge interest in it, because if it's an illegal grow, they're not getting revenue. And they really have been over time carrying a big chunk of the enforcement on illegal grows through county sheriffs and DAs. So it seems like, you know, and I know I've been an advocate for a long time for this, really trying to figure out how we tighten up our relationships with the counties is super important. And it's hard sometimes because a lot of our relationships with counties and cities is regulator to regulated. So, you know, it's like we're the water board, we're here to help you. You know, the cities and the counties take some of the same view that other kinds of dischargers do, you know, and but it seems like to the extent that we can really find ways to build those city county relationships, and I felt for a while like maybe we should be you know, having a senior staff person who's in charge of the overall relationship for each county. So, you know, to just manage it and grease it and nurture it. But it seems like it could really help us in this instance because they have such an aligned interest with us in getting tax money from legalizing grow operations.
Yeah, I will. So I agree with you on that. Certainly. I will say different counties are in different spots in terms of how ready they are to take action against illegal grows. I think each county has been figuring things out on its own, figuring out its permitting process, its enforcement process. Monterey County in particular, we've been having a really successful relationship with. We've worked closely with their DA, and we have been able to successfully help them get what's called a felony enhancement. When they go out and they find a site that is growing cannabis, it isn't enrolled with us because we're able to issue that water code violation. It gets upgraded to a felony. So then that helps the DA, you know, it's a bigger case that they would be more willing to take on rather than a misdemeanor. So we've had a really successful relationship with them. And I will just clarify one other point. So the way the cannabis general order is set up, we actually do receive enrollments for all indoor grows. Ones that are fully contained, they go into the waiver side of the permit. And basically they don't have annual reporting or anything like that, but we at least know where they are and that they have our permit, that kind of stuff. And then the other ones who, for example, have soil floors. So they're in a building, in a greenhouse, but soil floors, there is the potential for discharge. They go into our WDR side of the permit.
And I would also like to add in response to that, Arwen, you know, Mike, you indicated that, you know, indoor grows would not have a discharge, but even the indoor grows that are, you know, the hydroponic with a concrete floor, they do have discharges that are associated with the eventual discharge of their process water. You know, typically what they have are very technically proficient water treatment systems. They recycle the water. But eventually they have to get rid of some of that water. And so they do have discharges associated with those facilities that we need to be aware of and regulate.
Yeah. And a lot of them do store and haul their waste. And that's something that we've worked with a lot of them on to kind of help them figure out that process. You might notice, I'm not sure if it'll show up in this enforcement report, but we often see unregulated discharges, unpermitted discharge of reverse osmosis brine. A lot of cannabis growers use reverse osmosis prior to treat the water prior to applying it to their cannabis. And then of course you end up with brine. Some of them are applying it to land, which just isn't covered in the permit. And so we work with them to figure out, okay, how can you actually dispose of that waste in a environmentally conscious way?
It just strikes me that, you know, when we're dealing with sheriffs and DAs, they're elected officials that have a lot of things operating on them to determine what their priorities are. And the, you know, the tax revenues from permitted grows are probably more of interest to the county administrative officers than to the DAs and sheriffs. So, you know, it just, and those are the people we're often, you know, tangling with as we regulate their road construction and all that kind of stuff. So it just strikes me that, you know, if there's a way we can have a more holistic approach to building relationships with these county administrators and county bureaucracies outside of just the DA and sheriff that we interface with on the cannabis stuff, you know, those folks have an interest.
Thank you. So, Mr. Young, you were next.
Thank you. I hadn't finished my questions from before things got sidetracked. And I didn't catch the way the report is generated, that it doesn't continue all the way through cannabis cultivation, but it does have it mixed up with the other violations. So we have about 33 cannabis cultivation notices on here. How many permits do we have in total for cannabis?
In total, we have about 350, or I think we're actually closer to 400 enrolled sites now, and we have around maybe 285-ish WDR sites. So they're the ones that actually have to submit the annual report, and they're the ones who we focus on for our inspections, because the whole idea is they're higher risk to water quality. So when we're prioritizing our inspections, we're going to look at those types of sites.
Okay, so out of the 285, we have these 31 notices. Are there other notices that we're going to see in the next board meeting agenda item, or is this all of them that haven't submitted their technical reports?
So this covered everyone who didn't submit the March 1st annual report. And I will add to that, well, anyway, that's everyone who didn't submit that annual report. There are other reports that they're required to submit to us. We regularly send out notice of violation letters for these planning documents, a site management plan and a nitrogen management plan, that they're required to submit 90 days after they enroll with us. So we just have a rolling NOV situation for those. We send them out every couple months to get to notify the people who have subsequently enrolled.
Okay, so of these 31 that I see in the report, have you looked at whether these 31 participated in your workshop?
You know, I don't know that we've looked at that specifically, because it's not always abundantly clear who is attending the workshop. We don't require them to identify themselves. And we also posted the workshop online, and then we sent the link out to everybody so people could have viewed it. I will say our compliance rate in San Luis Obispo County was much higher, and we suspect that that has to do with the fact that the workshop was held at our office in SLO.
So that was an in-person?
It was in-person, and we recorded it.
Okay. So where I'm going with this is to try to see whether you can connect up those that have not participated and avail themselves of the workshop to those that are getting notices of violation.
I think it's likely. We can see what we can figure out there. Our plan really was to expand the workshop for next year and see if that helps in the other counties, you know, maybe hold one in Salinas or Watsonville, something like that, and see if that helps with those other counties as well.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Looking at my screen, I do not see any other hands raised. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Harvey.
So I got a quick response from staff about Mr. Young's question on Santa Barbara's wastewater. So Peter von Langen says that those PHREs violations were a result of cleaning carried on at the desal facility. So I'm sure they're figuring out a way to do a better job or figure out a better way of doing that in the future. So there's the answer.
Taya, you also wanted to say something.
I was just going to mention that Phil Hammer was here, and he probably had the answer on the pH issues, but Harvey just addressed that.
All right. So I'm looking at my screen here. I don't see any other comments from board members. So thank you, Tia, for your report. And at this time, I would like us to move to item 13, which is a stipulated order. And I will ask Matt to introduce that item. And also, I think you have a comment to make.
Yes, thank you. And I'd also just like to make a comment regarding previous item. Harvey, thank you for following up on the El Estero question. And I really appreciate that organic discussion about our cannabis program. I think what I'll do is I'll tell Arwen she doesn't need to give you guys an update for a while. I think we just covered it. So with respect to item number 13, as would be customary as the executive officer, I will not be able to act in an advisory role to the board for this item because I was involved in the development of this enforcement action in my previous role as the assistant executive officer. So I'll therefore be participating in this item as part of the prosecution team. And section manager Harvey Packard, he'll be introducing this item and he'll be acting in the lead advisory role to the board. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Harvey and Stephanie and see if they have anything else to add relative to introducing this item. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Keeling. So I'll have a small introduction here to introduce this item. Item 13 is a proposed stipulated administrative civil liability order and settlement agreement between the Central Coast Water Board Enforcement Team and Monterey Mushrooms, Inc. to resolve violations associated with alleged illegal discharges of wastewater to tributaries of Elkhorn Slough in 2017. Matthew Keeling was AEO and a member of the prosecution team during settlement negotiation, and therefore Stephanie, you, and I will serve as advisors to the board on this matter. The amount of the proposed penalty is nearly $1.2 million. The terms of the settlement include funding a supplemental environmental project in an amount of slightly more than 50% of the penalty. The Regional Board's enforcement team and Monterey Mushrooms are in agreement regarding the terms of the proposed order. The penalty amount exceeds the amount for which the Regional Board has delegated approval authority to the executive officer and therefore requires the Regional Board's approval. As a reminder, this proceeding is to consider the settlement agreement and is not an evidentiary hearing on the merits of the underlying allegations. The board will consider the proposed stipulated order and settlement agreement, oral comments from the prosecution team, and any comments from interested persons. Monterey Mushrooms does not plan to make a presentation today, but a representative is available for questions. The board members and the advisory team may ask questions of the parties concerning the settlement agreement. The board may approve the settlement agreement or may reject the agreement and give direction to staff to either schedule an evidentiary hearing to consider the allegations or to consider further settlement negotiations. Following the presentation and any public comments, the board may have discussion and may ask the advisory team for a recommendation. For the regional board's prosecution team are Taya Tryon and Paul Ciccarelli, an attorney with the State Board's Office of Enforcement. They'll provide a brief overview of the proposed order and settlement agreement. We also have Melissa Thorne, legal counsel for Monterey Mushrooms, and Heather Lucas of Community Water Center, available to answer questions regarding the approval of the settlement. We'll proceed with first hearing a presentation by the prosecution team and Monterey Mushrooms, if any, and then comments by interested persons, if any, a recommendation by the advisory team, and then board discussion and vote. So unless there's any questions now from the board, I'll turn the time over to Ms. Tryon.
Thank you, Harvey. Good morning, Chair Wolf, members of the board. My name is Taya Tryon. I'm the assistant executive officer and the lead for the enforcement team. And I will be providing you with a brief overview today of the proposed administrative civil liability order. But before that, I would like everybody to turn on their cameras from the rest of the enforcement team. So for this enforcement case, I want to acknowledge the hard work and from the rest of the enforcement team, which includes Paul Ciccarelli from the State Water Board Office of Enforcement, Brian Elder with the State Water Board Special Investigations Unit, and Christina Olmos and Jennifer Epp from the Waste Discharge Requirements Program here at the Central Coast Water Board. And then, of course, Matthew Keeling, who was the Assistant Executive Officer during the course of this enforcement case. I also noticed that Melissa Thorne just joined. If she has a camera, she could say hello. There she is. So with that, I am going to turn off my camera now and share my screen so you can see the presentation. Can someone please confirm that you can see the screen?
Yes.
We can see it.
Yep, we're good.
So as I mentioned, I'm here to present the proposed administrative civil liability order for Monterey Mushrooms, Inc. So the enforcement team and Monterey Mushroom Incorporated and its wholly owned subsidiary, Spawnmate Incorporated, entered into a settlement agreement to resolve violations associated with 14 separate unauthorized discharges of wastewater and contaminated stormwater from two mushroom growing facilities located in Monterey County. And the proposed settlement agreement or administrative civil liability order that we recommend you adopt today is included as attachment one to the staff report. Both of the facilities that are subject to the settlement agreement are regulated pursuant to the Central Coast Water Board waste discharge requirement permits since the 1980s. But before we continue, as I mentioned, I wanted to thank Melissa Thorne, legal counsel for Monterey Mushroom, for being here today to show her support on behalf of Monterey Mushroom, Inc. for the settlement agreement. The two mushroom growing facilities are located in Royal Oaks near Watsonville. The two light purple lines on this map represent major roads, Highway 1 on the left-hand side of the map and the 101 freeway in the bottom right-hand corner. The city of Watsonville is further north and not shown on this map, and the Moss Landing and Prunedale area is shown at the bottom. The location of one of the mushroom growing facilities is the 279-acre facility located at 777 Mayor Court, and the 14.3-acre facility located at 415 Hall Road. Both facilities are next to unnamed tributaries or creeks that drain to Elkhorn Slough. Water in the tributary located next to the Mayor Court facility takes about 6 miles to travel to Elkhorn Slough, and the water in the tributary next to the Hall Road facility takes about 2 miles to travel to Elkhorn Slough. So let's talk about wastewater. Monterey Mushroom, Inc. spawns, grows, harvests, and packages mushrooms, and the mushrooms grow on compost. At the time of the unauthorized discharges, both the Hall Road and Mayor Court facilities generated and stored compost on site. The compost typically contains straw with horse and or poultry manure, urea, and gypsum. This photo shows the brown-colored processed wastewater that is also known as compost leachate that can be generated in large quantities when stormwater comes in contact with the compost. This wastewater is required to be stored on site in wastewater ponds. So we first learned about the discharges of this wastewater to surface water from a Department of Fish and Wildlife warden that was investigating Monterey mushroom facilities. Samples collected during various inspections at the mushroom growing facilities indicated that this wastewater and the stormwater commingled with this wastewater contains ammonia at levels that are toxic to aquatic life, and it has excessive nutrients and suspended and floating material. So next, I will show an aerial photo of the two facilities and an example of an unauthorized discharge that occurred at the facility that encompasses this enforcement case. This is an aerial photo of the Mayor Court facility. The rectangular buildings are the growing rooms. The brown area near the top of the slide is the compost area, and pond 1 and 2 are shown in the right-hand corner, and these ponds receive wastewater. Pond 2 is located next to the tributary that drains to Elkhorn Slough. On 8 separate occasions, between January 8th and April 19, 2017, discharges of processed wastewater and contaminated stormwater occurred to the tributary of Elkhorn Slough from the Mayor Court facility. Those 8 discharges combined resulted in about 4 million gallons of wastewater discharged into surface water. The next couple of photos focus on the Pond 2 area. During the rain events in 2017, high volumes of stormwater and processed wastewater entered into Pond 2, causing the elevation of the Mayor Court Pond 2 to rise above its liner and overflow into its concrete spillway and discharge directly into the tributary. In this picture, the top of the liner is below the wastewater pond level, and the next photo will show the outlet of this pond, which is on the right-hand side of this photo in this area over here. So this is the Pond 2 spillway that shows wastewater discharging from the pond, and that discharge leads directly to the tributary. This is an aerial view of the Hall Road facility. You can see the wastewater pond in the upper right-hand corner of the photo, the compost area in brown, and the structures of growing rooms. The blue line represents the tributary to Elkhorn Slough, and between January 8 and February 20, 2017, 6 discharges of processed wastewater and contaminated stormwater discharged to the tributary at a combined total of about 620,000 gallons. I did want to note that Monterey Mushroom ceased mushroom growing operations on September 27, 2019, and they removed all spent compost from the facility by December 1st, 2019. Monterey Mushrooms now dehydrates mushrooms at the facility, and the dehydration process doesn't produce significant volumes of wastewater any longer. The next couple of photos will show a discharge that occurred in February 2017 from the wastewater pond and compost area to the tributary via a ditch that Monterey Mushroom dug to manage stormwater, as shown by the orange line at the top of the page. So in this photo, the wastewater pond is at the end of this ditch, and the tributary receiving the wastewater is at the bottom of the photo. The discharger dug this diversion ditch to preserve capacity in their wastewater ponds and to also manage stormwater runoff from a neighboring property. However, this picture shows that the discharger discharged wastewater from Baker tanks directly into this diversion ditch, which leads directly to the tributary. So both facilities have Central Coast Water Board waste discharge requirements that require all processed wastewater, including stormwater commingled with processed wastewater and or other waste generated at the mushroom growing facilities, to be placed and contained in the facility's wastewater ponds. Both the Mayor Court permit and Hall Road permits prohibit the discharge of any waste to waters of the United States, adjacent drainage ways, or adjacent properties. Therefore, the discharges of waste violated the Central Coast Water Board permit prohibitions, in addition to the Clean Water Act Section 301, which prohibits point source discharges of pollutants to waters of the U.S. without a permit. The Water Code and the State Water Board Enforcement Policy prescribe how the water boards assess liability for violations. For these violations, we assess liability pursuant to Water Code Section 13385, which addresses violations of the Clean Water Act. the enforcement team conducted an assessment of all the factors outlined in the enforcement policy and as detailed in Attachment A to the settlement agreement, and based on the enforcement policy, calculated a penalty according to the penalty calculation methodology and assessed the penalty of $1,169,425 for the combined total of the 14 unauthorized discharges. And considering all factors, the enforcement team finds that this proposed liability fully eliminates any economic or unfair competitive advantage Monterey Mushroom may have obtained from its noncompliance, and it creates a deterrent to Monterey Mushrooms and similar situated businesses or persons from committing same or similar violations. So this slide shows a quick breakdown of the total penalty and how it's distributed. $569,650, which includes $37,103 for staff costs to process this enforcement case, will go to the State Water Board cleanup and abatement account. The remainder of the liability, which is nearly $600,000, will be suspended upon completion of a supplemental environmental project. As you know, a supplemental environmental project, or SEP, is an environmentally beneficial project that a person subject to an enforcement action voluntarily agrees to undertake in settlement to offset approximately 50% of a civil penalty. Monterey Mushrooms proposes to implement a third-party performed SEP executed by the Community Water Center. And in summary, the SEP consists of a pilot project for 123 trichloropropane, or 123 TCP, point of entry household level water treatment for up to 20 disadvantaged community households in the unincorporated area of northern Monterey County, where the residents rely on groundwater wells with high levels of 123 TCP for drinking water. A vast majority of program beneficiaries are located in the disadvantaged community with low income in the area north of Moss Landing. The objective of the point of entry household level water treatment is to effectively treat the 123 TCP to levels below the maximum contaminant level for drinking water, consistent with the human right to water. The goal is to install the point of entry treatment systems by March 31st, 2021, and continue maintaining and monitoring the systems through June 2023, which is the extent of time specified in the SEP policy for a SEP project. I believe Heather Lucas is joining us today, and I would like to thank Heather Lucas from the Community Water Center for being here to help answer any specific questions you may have about this particular SEP at the end of this presentation. So the enforcement team recommends that the board adopt the proposed administrative civil liability order to resolve the violations associated with numerous unauthorized discharges from the two mushroom growing facilities. Monterey Mushrooms has invested significant capital to improve operations to date, and our program staff continue to work cooperatively with Monterey Mushroom staff and their consultants to improve operation at their facilities to ensure they can contain wastewater on site as required by their permits. Your action today by adopting this proposed order will also initiate a SEP that is expected to improve drinking water impacted with 123 TCP for up to 20 disadvantaged community households near the location where the discharges occurred, which is aligned with one of our highest priority goals to further the human right to water in our region.
So at this time, thank you, Taya. Appreciate the presentation. At this time, Harvey, do you have any other presenters before I ask if we do have public comments? And then I will ask our board to engage in the Q&As.
Yeah, I have a couple things to say here. One, in my role as Zoom coordinator, I don't see Heather Lucas involved in the meeting today, so it doesn't look like she's available to answer questions on the SEP. And also, Taya, I forgot to mention at the beginning that there was an email from the prosecution team about some typos in the order. Can you please go over that and make sure the board is clear on that?
Absolutely. So if the board adopts this order, we, the enforcement team, issued a email to the advisory team on July 15, which requests that we make some 3 non-substantive typos to the stipulated order. The first one is for the proposed stipulated order. In section 3, paragraph 19, page 10, in the last sentence, it says settlement respondents, and it's missing an apostrophe. And we'd like to change it to settling respondents with an apostrophe to represent one respondent instead of multiple respondents. Additionally, another change is in order section, paragraph 2, page 15. The task description for task IDA currently states in part, pay $569,850, and this should actually be pay $569,650. These changes do not change the order or how it's, the stipulation is just a typo. The other one is an attachment A of proposed stipulated order, which is step 8, economic benefit, page A27. The last sentence of the second paragraph under step 8 currently states that the economic benefit amount for violation 1 through 14 is $1,043,504. And the dollar amount should be changed to $1,029,383. The enforcement staff costs were incorrectly added in this section, but they were correct in other portions of the section. So we would like to propose that if you adopt this order today, that those minor typos are corrected in the final stipulated order.
Thank you, Taya.
Thank you. And Chair, let me point out that Heather Lucas has joined the meeting. So That's good to see. Perhaps we can give the opportunity to Ms. Thorm if she would like to say anything at this point.
Okay.
I don't have anything to add except that we support the board adopting this order as proposed today.
Okay, thank you. And we have no public comment in line for this. So Chair Wolf, we can turn it over to the board.
Okay, so we'll now, we'll formally engage our board with Q&As on this particular item. And, you know, certainly feel free. So since we do have several participants here, Harvey, to help direct a little bit where the question should go to as appropriate. So
okay.
That's in advance. So I'm looking at my screen let's see.
We have Dr. Hunter and Michael Johnston.
Okay, let me move my cursor here so I can see everybody's hands. Okay, all right. So who was first?
Monica was first.
All right, Dr. Hunter, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. And welcome, Heather. I do have questions. I'd just like to hear from you regarding how this project will move forward from your end. I am very happy to see these monies being dedicated to working on a problem that was pretty much identified, in particular household, at the household level, by your program. And so I am wondering how 20 up to 20, how that reflects on the overall problem, the size of the problem, scope of the problem. I know it's limited geographically under SEP criteria, but if you could give us an idea of how this program will inform and perhaps model potential solutions. And if you have already begun to understand where additional funding might come, I noticed that following June 2023, there is an expectation that CWC will identify funds to continue monitoring this set of 20 and potentially expand the program. So anything you can tell us about what you know now, I know it's early, but whatever you can add to this would be great to know.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Hi, everyone. Good to see you. And we are in full support of this project, and it is an exciting one. It is a pilot, and you'll see the way we have it set up is actually a two-phased pilot to really, and one of the main, well, there are two main goals, and one is to reduce exposure immediately for households that have 1-3 TCP contamination. And the second goal is really what Dr. Hunter, what you're getting at, which is the second goal is to pilot and get good cost information. It will serve, you know, up to 20 households, this pilot project, but the hope is that this will actually inform efforts statewide, that, you know, future work by Community Water Center, but by many other organizations. It's a really unique pilot that stands to benefit a much larger scope. We will be developing a technical advisory committee that will hopefully facilitate the sharing of what we glean from this study so that it can benefit many more people. So it is a very exciting pilot, and we support this item today. So thank you.
And Heather, do you see this kind of pilot effort for Community Water Center? Is this a model for other ways in which we're going to be able to benefit from some of the monies that are coming online for disadvantaged communities and contaminated water, where we're actually treating water at the household level? Is this something you see your program focusing on and becoming an important tool in addressing individual households?
I think we need to learn more. I think it's certainly an interim solution. And for issues like TCP, where there's exposure in the shower, I think having point of entry treatment, so water treated at the whole household level. Some other things we're doing are with this project are specifically having an operation and maintenance contract for the duration, making sure that there's monitoring done to make sure these devices work. And I think this is really consistent with Community Water Center's overall view of these household technologies, is that it has to be done well. And it has to be thoughtful with monitoring, with operation and maintenance. It's not just a quick fix. And so I think that we're really looking forward to learning from this study as one potential solution, certainly in the interim. And we will see from there.
Excellent. Yeah, that's what I was trying to get to, is I don't see, you know, when we're talking about statewide programs and statewide levels, typically we're not operating at the level of individual, you know, impacting individual users. And so this is very, I agree with you, this is very exciting, and we'll be anxious to see how the process unfolds. And will your organization be actually reviewing service providers in this, in the design and the engineering? Is that you're managing the advisory group overall, and you, who will be making the final decisions on what the design will look like and how it'll operate and how it'll be installed and so forth?
We will be hiring a consultant who will be doing that. We'll be reviewing proposals with support from the advisory committee. Ultimately, we will select the, you know, the consultant, the engineering firm that will be doing the design in all of this. It'll be a competitive process, So, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Good to see you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hunter. Next, we have Mr. Johnston, and then I will have a question after that myself. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, the SEP project is, I like the SEP project. It looks like a really worthwhile project. I'm a little confused about the, and I'd like to hear more from the prosecution team about the amount of the recommended settlement. You know, I see that after going through the whole matrix of impact, culpability, gallonage, everything else, the base liability amount is north of $14 million, and the recommended settlement is an order of magnitude less than that, is in the neighborhood of a tenth of that, and I would like to hear why, because it seems like there's not necessarily dispute that the discharge occurred. I don't know if there's dispute over the gallonage of the discharge. I don't know. I mean, typically, if the recommended settlement amount is substantially less than the base liability, it's because the expense of litigation or some question as to whether we would prevail in litigation. So I would like to hear from the prosecution team on that.
Thank you. I think that's a great question. And it's always an important decision to determine where in the range between minimum and maximum penalties we resolve the violations. For this particular stipulated order, we did choose the base liability plus 10% economic benefit, which is the lower portion of the penalty that we can assess. However, this particular case, there are multiple cases that had been going on, and Paul Ciccarelli, legal counsel, he was involved with other enforcement items that occurred for Monterey Mushroom Incorporated. So we incorporated as justice may require, we incorporated all the other enforcement actions that were going on. And so I'm going to share my screen to show you a summary of all the other enforcement cases associated with Monterey Mushroom that we considered when we assessed this penalty. And I'll let Paul speak to that.
Thank you, Taya. My name is Paul Ciccarelli. I'm counsel for the prosecution team. I represented the Central Coast Regional Water Board in this enforcement action, as well as the enforcement action which took place in the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Core Board District. So the case before you today is the last piece of a very complicated multi-jurisdictional, multi-agency joint investigation that was led by the Department of Fish and Wildlife and involved the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board, the San Francisco Bay Water Board, and four district attorney offices, including Santa Clara County, Monterey County, San Luis Obispo County, and Santa Cruz County. Monterey Mushrooms has settled three other enforcement actions related to its management of compost and wastewater, including stormwater at its California facilities, including the Mayor Court and Hall Road facilities, which are the subject of the enforcement action today. In Region 2 alone, Monterey Mushrooms facility in Morgan Hill was subject to two enforcement actions, one by the Regional Water Board and one by the Santa Clara County DA's office. And those liability amounts are represented in this slide. The Region 2 stipulated administrative civil liability order was adopted on April 2nd, 2020. It imposed $911,800 in liability for the same Clean Water Act type violations, which resulted from a discharge of leachate from a spent compost field, as well as discharges of polluted stormwater from a pond. About half of that penalty will also be going towards a supplemental environmental project, a third party proposed SEP, which will do habitat restoration on the creeks where the discharges occurred. The Santa Clara DA, the Monterey County action, which involved other DAs, are summarized for you here on the slide. The total DA actions resulted in $2,545,000 in civil penalties and resulted also in multiple injunctions that prohibit the discharge of wastewater and require sampling of unauthorized discharges and also requiring the training and proper operation and management of its wastewater operations. In addition to this, the company has spent upwards of $11.2 million on various compliance, containment, and remediation projects to comply with its WDRs. It has also resulted in significant change in operations at two of its facility. You know, Monterey Mushrooms is claiming that it's a typical farming operation that has thin margins, and a result of the expenditures for the compliance actions and the other liabilities amount has had to significantly reduce operations at its Hall Road facility, which you were presented on today, and its facility in Arroyo Grande, which is not subject to this enforcement action. In November 2017, Monterey Mushrooms reported that compost and white mushroom production ceased at Arroyo Grande. So now they are converted to production of shiitake mushrooms without compost. This change in operations at Arroyo Grande caused Monterey Mushrooms to lay off 31 employees. And the change in operations at the Hall Road facility, which Taya summarized for you today, and now they're moving only to a mushroom dehydration process, which only requires around 4 to 6 employees. This has led Monterey Mushrooms to lay off an additional 91 employees at this facility. So in total, the total civil liability amount for the DA's actions and the administrative actions is over $4.6 million. And the total costs, which include liability and expenses, are approximately $15.8 million. So when we were determining what is the appropriate enforcement amount for this action, we looked to the minimum liability amount required by the enforcement policy, that's economic benefit, plus 10%, including all the additional staff costs, which were incurred as a result of this enforcement action. But considering all these factors, including the hearing and litigation risks related to equitable factors and mitigating circumstances, the enforcement team found that this proposed liability fully eliminates any economic or competitive advantage Monterey Mushrooms may have obtained. And it's an appropriate deterrent, not only for Monterey Mushrooms, but for other similarly situated discharges in the state. But I'm happy to answer any other questions you may have about what we really put into considering as to why this $1.2 million was sufficient.
Thank you. I think, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. If I understand correctly, the $11+ million is expenditures that Monterey Mushroom made on their own facilities so that they could operate in compliance with the permits which they had had for some time. Is that correct?
Correct.
I'm still a little flummoxed by the. Can you speak a little bit to the uncertainties of litigation and as to whether we would prevail in litigation?
I mean, that's a hard issue to address. You know, these were a result. The settlement was a result of confidential settlement communications. The evidence underlying this case is mainly developed by the Department of Fish and Wildlife. All of the sample results were either taken by Department of Fish and Wildlife or the discharger itself. So the total volume amount and most of the samples that show the contents of the processed water that was discharged were reported by the discharger itself at the request of the water board. So beginning of this wet season, we asked the discharger to notify us of any unauthorized discharges and to sample that discharge if an unauthorized discharge would occur. And at the end of that rain season, we issued Water Code Section 13267 orders to investigate that. So they reported on the volume and they provided limited water quality sampling of those discharge, mainly showing the levels of total ammonia and nitrogen that are present in the processed water at the facilities. But other than that, there are limited receiving water samples for this case. There was only 2 which are cited, and that was taken on one day by Department of Fish and Wildlife on 2 separate discharge occasions, but analogy was made that if the process water levels are consistent generally over the facilities and the receiving waters are somewhat similar, there was an analogy made across those two receiving water samples that all discharges, in fact, cause that similar harm across all the 14 discharge events. So there are some assumptions made in this analysis, but the focus here was making sure that this action itself was an appropriate determinant given the gravity of the situation and the amount of enforcement actions and uncertainty that were present at the time when four DA's offices, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and other regional water board were at the table. So it was a very coordinated effort, and all of the resulting liability amounts are similar across each settlement action.
Okay, I'm frankly still not completely convinced when I see, you know, approximately, what was it, about $3 million in total liability, and the base liability just in our region's incidents being of $14 million when you factor in culpability, impact, everything else. But I think I'll defer to give other board members a chance to ask questions. I may circle back around.
Mike, can I ask a follow-up question that might help, hopefully? Taya, a lot of the spill violations that the board sees are raw sewage. Can you compare the threat or harm of the Monterey mushrooms type of discharge versus raw sewage? And then maybe if you have any information available on per gallon penalties on raw sewage versus this one?
Before you answer, I would point out that that is one of the factors that is rated in the attachment, the toxicity. So in the $14 million base amount number, that is considered.
So this is compost leachate, it's not sewage. The harm factor is similar or higher to a discharge of sewage. It's a little different for each facility. Most of our evaluations were based on ammonia toxicity. And we did have samples for the wastewater and for the surface water. And so it's similar, maybe a little higher harm. The other thing is the maximum penalty is associated or is calculated assuming $10 per gallon and $10,000 per day for the discharge. Typically with high volume discharges, we do not penalize it to the $10 per gallon because obviously it runs up the penalty amount quite a bit. And so that is the expanse that you have to consider, that it is rare that we issue $10 per gallon, $10,000 per day for high volume discharges. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think that helps. Thank you.
All right. So I'll ask my specific question. And this relates to the, you know, the SEP allocation of let's round it the number to $600,000. And in previous SEPs, at times the monies were allocated to basically a trust, for example, managed by the Bay Foundation, example, when we had years ago UniCal, and then these monies is used and dispersed for various projects, benefiting the area. We've had SEPs where the monies are used specifically to remedy the impact that was made to the environment. And, you know, my question here, I will preface that I believe we have an excellent relationship with the community water center. So that's not an issue whatsoever. I'll characterize as a partner. But I see that this what derives the penalties were based on fish and wildlife assessment of impact of discharge into the creek. Therefore, typically in SEPs, some of the ideas are to address the issue of remedying what was damages done to the environment. I don't see any linkage there to address the use of the penalties to even partially remedy the impact done to the environment. And I guess I'm a little confused of, you know, yes, we do have this partnership with the Community Water Center, but they basically almost come across like we're sole sourcing $600,000 and say, okay, we'll do some work. And maybe I'm totally missing the point, but I don't see a real plan. There's no budget. I guess I need a little better understanding. Certainly I realize here that all the parties are in agreement to use this route, but I think, you know, $600,000 is not a negligible amount of money, and I would like to get a little more, a little better understanding of why we chose this project, and there was no allocation to address the actual direct impact. Using again the analogy of water treatment facilities, if there's a discharge that took place in a creek, often the project includes some restoration of X amount of miles of riparian corridor. It includes, in some instance, we have agreed on ACL for non-regulatory required enhancement of the facility to improve the water quality. So I need a little more background on how we came with this project. Certainly, again, there's no question, you know, the issue of TCP, disadvantaged community, you know, is very worthy, but I think I'd like to understand better the whole decision process. So sure. I'm not sure who can answer that.
I'm happy to start the answer. Mm-hmm. Just a reminder that we didn't choose this project. The discharger proposed this project.
Right.
So as part of a settlement agreement, when a discharger proposes a supplemental environmental project, or the one you're referring to is an enhanced compliance action, this one is a supplemental environmental project, and they proposed it to us. The first thing we do is to see if it complies with the State Water Board SEP policy. And in the SEP policy, there is a criteria that you either comply with the nature of the violation or there's a geographic nexus to the violation. So that's where this one falls. It's within 50 miles of where the discharge occurred, and it's going to benefit the community where the discharge occurred. So in terms of options for SEPs, right now we don't have the CCAMP gap avenue to pursue at this point either. And so we felt that the SEP was met to complied with the SEP policy. It does have a general budget and tasks. We will be requiring quarterly reports to ensure that progress is made in accordance with how it's stipulated in the settlement order. And so at any time where we determine that the SEP is not complying with what the intent of the stipulated order was, we can require the discharger to send the money to the cleanup and abatement account. So Does that help answer your question?
Partially, but thank you. We're making progress. How many households are we talking about? Because you know, I see the number of 20 community areas. So, you know, we're talking about TCP sampling in X amount of household, correct? Which would be most likely private wells. Is that correct statement?
Yes, I can answer that. Yeah, it's a full a way to think about it is a pilot that of 1-2-3 TCP treatment. So it will involve two phases, a proof of concept phase. So you're thinking a site assessment of each particular location, including sampling, preliminary sampling that is needed to make sure that these treatment systems are designed in a way that will treat the TCP. And this will be for some constituents that weren't previously sampled. And then you're looking at design of those systems, installation, monitoring. And this will be monitoring both parameters, you know, around how the treatment system's working and also sampling for 1-2-3 TCP itself, which is expensive, as I think you know, to sample for on a routine basis, and also operation and maintenance costs, which we hope will be low, but that'll be contracted out. And by doing a phased approach of doing, you know, 1-3 systems this fall, the idea is that we can really hone in on the costs and make sure that we can reach as many households as possible in the second phase. But I just want to reiterate that as a pilot, we see that this will have big picture implications for the state really on this issue. To our knowledge, there's been no pilot of this type, especially with this attention to the detail that we believe necessary to do this sort of treatment right. So it is a pilot. The houses, you know, 20 houses or so may seem few, but if you compare it to something like the UCLA pilot project where you have three systems installed, I think that this sort of 20 systems, even at the household scale, will provide a lot of really important information. And we plan to do that in a way that's very open in sharing the information with state agencies and all sorts of different partners. I think I can't really add a lot to what Thea said about the connection to the discharger. The only thing I can say is that we are working so close to this area in Las Lomas and surrounding. So there is the connection, the geographic connection. I think we're less than 5 miles away, and some of the households are really just around the corner. So, you know, there's a close geographic nexus for this project. When this came up as a possibility, it was really framed as how can this benefit the local community? And all parties involved really wanted to see a benefit for people in that area, you know, specifically around the facilities. And so I think that's how it came on our radar. And we said, yeah, we work with low-income communities. We can provide that nexus. And then we worked to develop a project that we thought could ultimately have the largest impact and that did not have really alternative options for funding. So this was a way to complement existing funding that we have for other types of pilots in an area that we think could make the biggest impact.
You know, and I appreciate your response and actually you gave me the segue to an analogy I was going to use with the UCLA project. And if I look at the UCLA project and refresh my memory, Harvey or Taya, but I think this is probably a fourth or fifth year we started this project. And we finally just got one of the system online and fast forward, we're looking at, I believe we passed $1.5 to $2 million now and we're just starting to get the system in line, and once social distancing is no longer an issue, we're going to have finally a ribbon cutting ceremony. But where I'm getting at is, you know, here's UCLA that already had, you know, some of the systems designed, and there was software enhancements, et cetera, with a modular system. It involved significant amount of permits, and in actually they were looking at their, you know, basically their RO technology to denitrify, and then using the discharge into the septic system, of applying it to other constituents, because if you take that technology, it's not exclusive to removing nitrates. So, and I'm not trying to get into the weeds, because I realize you haven't started the project, but I guess, unfortunately, this is a little bit of my engineering kicking in here. I'm like, are we trying to do something totally new and separate, and not trying to look at perhaps technology developed and say, all right, we, Community Water Center, we're going to focus on TCP, but rather than, you know, hiring own brand new consultants coming with brand new approach of treatment, et cetera. See, you pointed out correctly, there's no system in place. However, has there been any thinking about the synergy perhaps that can be gained by, you know, the significant amount of work that has been done with UCLA under the same umbrella, you know, of disadvantaged communities?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. And I appreciate the question, and I realize I may have confused a couple of things. So one, I'll note two differences here between those pilots. I think they're both pilots to inform, you know, scaling technology. So that's a similarity. But two important differences are, number one, we're only using proven technology. So it's not a new technology. It's best available. I think it's classified as a best available technology, you know, granular activated carbon. It's this application, you know, doing a pilot at the household scale, that, you know, in studying it, like what it truly costs to operate and maintain it. I think that's the part that's new. So the technology itself, we're going to use the standard technology, and we're going to look for people to implement, who have already implemented the same technology. So it's not the same as the UCLA pilot project, which is a new technology. This will be proven technology. And so I just want to clarify that. And then the second big difference, really, I think, is that there aren't, to our knowledge, and we've been in touch with County Environmental Health, State Water Board, and others, because this is private wells, you know, this isn't a requirement. So the permitting will be much easier. In fact, there will be very limited permitting, if any, required for this particular technology. So I think that's another difference compared to UCLA. I know they've had a lot of challenges and also made a lot of grounds in permitting. And then I guess if I offered a third difference, is that the waste disposal from these technologies is also really different. And so I think that is going to be less of an issue treating TCP with this particular granular granulated activated carbon technology. So I think from our perspective, we should be able to move. We are confident that we can move forward on this timeline. I think I only meant to draw that analogy because I think it's similar in that it's a pilot that can impact a wider, you know, that's important statewide. So we're definitely not reinventing the wheel. We're not inventing a new technology, only proven tech.
Yeah, I was asking this because you did mention, and we also may be able to look at other constituents. So other constituents, I drew the fact that, in fact, the area you're looking at, I do believe we do have nitrate issues in some mm-hmm. of the wells, correct? So I thought, okay, if you're talking about our constituents, you probably is thinking, you know, I'll call it the go-to nitrates and, you know, who knows what else. So that's what triggered me taking your inputs and say, well, okay, is there a way of perhaps bundling, so to speak, the treatment so we don't have a situation of, oh, we're using, you know, and I'm familiar with, you know, the type of filters you talk about. In fact, it's used here in San Luis Obispo County, where we have a plume not far from us, from the water board. So, you know, I don't think where you want to go is to have, well, okay, we have TCP, so we're using that. Oh, well, we have nitrates, so we're going to use under the sink RO. And again, I don't want to get into too much of a detail, but I felt because of the amount of dollars involved in this project, that it's behooved having a little better understanding, elucidation, of what is being proposed here. So thank you for being patient with me and answering, you know, my questions. And at this time, I took enough time. I'm going to let my colleagues ask additional questions.
Chair Wolf,
yes.
I have a quick point I want to make. Okay. So, you know, Taya was talking about evaluating SEPs with respect to compliance with the SEP policy. And I just wanted to point out that the proposed SEP is in significant alignment with the SEP policy. The SEP policy has a section on the front end that discusses that, you know, SEPs need to support the Water Board's mission. And there's a significant emphasis within that discussion on human right to water and environmental justice, and also climate change. But the proposed SEP meets the two, you know, human right to water, environmental justice components of it. And I'll just read to you just a quick sentence here. Section 8 of this policy sets forth specific provisions designed to encourage settling parties to consider SEPs related to drinking water that would benefit public health and further the human right to water. There's a similar statement in the environmental justice paragraph on the front end of the SEP policy. So along with the geographic nexus, there's a very significant Water Board mission nexus with respect to this SEP. And I just wanted to make sure that was clear to everybody.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, Matt. And before, you know, I asked Jeff and then Monica, saw both raising hand. I want to make sure it is clear to everyone. I'm not questioning at all whether or not this $600,000 is not appropriate for you know, the human right to safe drinking water. That was not my point. My point was, it was pretty short in specificity in terms of what are we going to do in are we engaging brand new technologies? Are we on the leading edge, but leading edge or where? That's where my questions came from. So I want to make sure everybody understands. I do value, you know, the benefit of this SEP, and I understand it is for a very good cause. So, and I want to make sure that's clear to everyone.
Yeah.
So,
if I could just quickly interject and just remind everyone that in this particular proceeding, Mr. Keeling is acting as the prosecution team, but that notwithstanding, I do agree with his assessment of his read of the SEP policy. I do agree with what he just stated.
And again, I did not question that. Mr. Young.
Thank you. I appreciate all the discussion. It's very helpful. And, you know, I do agree with the SEP and how the funds will be used. At the same time, I do appreciate Chair Wolf's questions on there being a lack of specificity on exactly how the funds will be used. I'd like to go back if I could, because I want to say that I share Mr. Johnston's concerns about how the final liability amount has been calculated at. I need help. Where does this 10% come from? I read from step 10, we've got the economic benefit plus 10%. What factors went into determining 10% was an appropriate add-on?
Hi, this is Paul Chikri. I'll start. So the enforcement policy describes how, you know, the liability amounts are calculated. So you look at the mandated statutory requirement of what the minimum liability would be under Water Code Section 13385, and that is economic benefit itself. So as a statutory requirement, a penalty should at least recoup economic benefit. Now, the enforcement policy directs the board to consider the economic benefit plus 10% to set a liability that eliminates any unfair advantage and recoup any of the economic benefit that might that facility might have gained from its non-compliance, and to eliminate, you know, the violation as a look of a cost of doing business. I can have Brian Elder, he is here available today to explain a little bit more about economic benefit and how that was used in this case to determine an appropriate liability. But I do want to add that this case not only recoups economic benefit plus 10% as required by our enforcement policy, it also recoups over $37,000 in staff costs that are associated with this case.
Well, and I do understand that the staff costs to me are separate. And the 10% is 10% of what?
Brian, could you step in and maybe give a little explanation of that factor?
And then when Brian does that, why not 20%? Why not 25? Why not 30%?
Well, it sounds to me, Paul, that the question is really about where the 10% is 10% over economic benefit. And I think as Paul described, you know, my role is to calculate economic benefit. The enforcement policy then sets an additional 10% of that economic benefit as essentially the floor of the policy calculation. Is that correct, Paul?
Yes.
Why is it 10? I believe that's just how the policy is written.
So that's the floor, is the 10% over.
Yes.
Correct.
According to the enforcement policy, according to the water code, it's just economic benefit.
Okay, why isn't economic benefit the $11 million that they're now paying to come into compliance with the permit?
So those costs are associated from all their California facilities, and they are not directly related to the specific violations that were alleged. They had generally, you know, and a lot of that was discretionary spending about how that discharger wanted to come into compliance with this permit, whether that's, you know, redirecting, you know, stormwater flows on its facility or doing infrastructure improvements, doing canopies. It could have had a very much factors on, you know, its choice of how to come into compliance with these permits. But those costs are just general costs that were incurred since the enforcement investigation proceeded, but they're not necessarily tied to our allegations or the violations at issue.
So if we take that number and break it down to the funds spent at just the facilities at issue in this matter, what does that number come down to?
It you know, if I could jump in, it's still not exactly that simple. And the rationale there is that when you're looking at economic benefit, economic benefit is looking at either avoided costs of compliance or delayed costs of compliance. In those cases where you may be looking at some of these long-term strategies that they're now implementing to, you know, correct drainage, to correct storage, those types of things, those would be considered delayed actions. And while, you know, I think Michael had mentioned earlier, some of those actions may have been necessary at the time that they initially you know, got their WDR. However, it's again, how operations have changed over the decades. That's a pretty hefty analysis to start to look at. You know, should they have spent $10 million you know, 10 years ago may not necessarily have been required versus spending $10 million today. Those operations would have changed over time. So the reasonable analysis in the economic benefit calculation really looked at sort of the immediate need for temporary storage, which was actually a corrective action they took to attempt to mitigate some of those discharges related to this particular action.
But those sums still, you know, regardless of how you look backward in time.
I agree, but they're delayed. So you would be looking more at the, you know, potentially the time value of not having to spend that money previously versus spending that money now, rather than there's $10 million in compliance costs. That should be considered an avoided cost. It's not avoided because technically they're spending the money now. Had they, you know, should they have spent that even 5 years ago, we would be potentially looking at that time value of money. There's some other factors that enter into that as well in terms of tax deductibility of compliance costs. And so, you know, there certainly potentially is a delayed benefit there. But again, it's an analysis that I believe they're still implementing corrective actions. Not all of those corrective actions would have necessarily mitigated these particular violations. They may improve drainage, they may improve storage, but they may not necessarily have directly impacted these particular discharges. So again, it's a little bit tricky to sort of just parse out the exact costs that they're incurring today as a mitigation method or mitigation action for those particular discharges. So again, we look specifically at temporary immediate storage and disposal.
Thank you.
So next, Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. And I appreciate the chance to comment additional to my first round of questions. So I think we've all heard the description of how this project connects to SEP criteria. So I don't think there's a question of that. And I appreciate your clarifying some of those aspects. I also had those questions, and so it's good to hear a little more detail. But I did want to respond additionally, Chair Wolf. There is a budget in the very final section of this order as attachment B. And I thought one of the things that I do appreciate about CWC, and you mentioned the Bay Foundation, for example, and the track record they have in managing funds. We know this about CWC as well, statewide, in their different organizations operating both in the San Joaquin and the Central Valley. And now, fortunately for us, we have a growing program and presence related to water quality issues in education and outreach. And they're leading this effort in partnership with us, as well as working, again, at the local level and local scale. So those kinds of program benefits are extremely difficult to bring online case by case. So we're building, a conduit both of information, technical outreach and education and so forth, as well as building relationships and assisting us to extend the data, which is critical to any kind of action that we take involving residents and landowners and getting their cooperation and getting voluntary participation in these kinds of pilot projects to demonstrate what the benefits are, as well as we've seen with UCLA, the challenges, which can be extremely complicated and unforeseen often at the beginning. But I think my bottom line comment is, when you look at that budget, over 70% of project monies are dedicated to the actual project design, implementation, maintenance, and operation and monitoring. And again, CWC, I think, has an extremely good track record of being effective and efficient in their management costs. Again, they will be promoting technical information about 123 TCP, which was something we did not understand the prevalence of this contaminant in that area without the CWC initial work in well testing and acquiring permission, voluntary permission for us to start looking at that area surrounding the Watsonville area. So their ability to continue to build public understanding and awareness of this particular contaminant, as well as nitrates and others, is something that they are already have a good momentum going and a good network building and trust building with the community. And then they have also committed, and I think Heather mentioned this and I hadn't considered it until she brought it up, the value of understanding the cost per household as a feature of the pilot experience is another benefit to understanding interim kinds of solutions for households that are experiencing, as you pointed out, multiple contaminants in their drinking water and in their household water supply. Again, so I think they are in a good position to advance multiple outcomes here beyond the 20 households, which is, I know everyone can see that and understand that, but I just want to really emphasize the cost effectiveness of how that 600 is being applied. And I'm really impressed with the efficiency. I mean, they're less than 30% to manage it, do the outreach, report on a technical level to the partners and to agencies what they're learning and what the experience is, as well as completing reports and making that available beyond the initial pilot project. So that those are just some additional comments to bring into this discussion.
Thank you. Ms. Gray.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate all the dialogue here and all my colleagues' good questions. So I pardon my ignorance of the enforcement policy, but can somebody illuminate for me a little bit further on the culpability factor? It seems like it's fairly limited in the ability to determine culpability between a 1.1 and a 1.5. What's the rationale for that?
Hi, yeah, so for the culpability here, and again, this application was done under the previous enforcement policy, but we look at, you know, less culpability should be assessed for accidental than for negligent or intentional violations. So for the analysis of this factor, I mean, it is somewhat discretionary in that what are we looking at? Are we looking at a 1.0? Is this neutral? They did everything they were supposed to be doing, or a 1.5? You know, they were 100% wrong. They did it on purpose and they did it with complete disregard. We kind of looked at the history of interactions with the water board for this case to determine the culpability scores. And we do notice there were some recent, in the early 2000s, some notices of violations after water board's inspections where similar types of violations were identified, which we used, say, you know, you had a little more advanced notice of these potential problems with your capacity related to your processed water storage in the past. While they do, you know, all of those responses at NOV show corrective actions taken by the company in response to those notices of violations, but, you know, they didn't really address the entire issue of being able to hold all their wastewater on site when we have significant rainy seasons like we did in 2017. So we just kind of looked at not only the notice they were provided from their permitting about what they should or shouldn't do, but other interactions with the board to show them, you know, how they can do corrective actions to be more in compliance with their order.
I appreciate all that. I guess I feel like it's a very narrow range. Why isn't there a consideration of 1 to 3 or 1 to 5? It seemed like there would be a little bit more opportunity to then, you know, assess a greater detailed understanding of the situation.
Yeah, so the current enforced policy, which is not at play in this case, but the current policy, I believe, allows a factor of 0.75 to 1.5. So 1.5 being the max, and I believe that was the max in the previous enforcement policy as well.
Right, I just feel like it's narrow. Okay, I'm glad that it's been expanded, thanks.
So at this time, maybe we should move into discussion of the board with the rest of our prosecution team here to take this to the next step before we do engage in a more formal consideration of this item. And I believe that was the proposed next step. Correct, Harvey?
Yes, that's correct. If you want, I can point out a few things that I've heard today that I think are important.
And before we do that, I'm looking at the time. We've been nonstop. It's 11:15, and it might be good for everyone to take a quick little 15-minute pause, and then it'll give you a chance to also put the rest of your input together here, Harvey. Okay?
Okay, so, yeah, sounds good.
Chair Wolf, can I just interject for a moment?
Absolutely.
There's a few members of the prosecution team that have to go to another court-related hearing-related appointment at noon.
All right.
That's one. I have until one.
But I believe Melissa also has a commitment at noon.
Okay.
Melissa, can you confirm that?
I can be a little late to that if need be.
I think, you know, I mean, this is very important, and I want to make sure, you know, all of us have a clear head, and I myself need a break right now. So let's reconvene at 11:30. So that's just 13 minutes from now. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, hold on one second. Let us get us everything started recording and thumbs up from the boards. Mr. Chair, the floor is yours.
Thank you. So at this time, Harvey, I would like you to engage the advisory team with my fellow board members in the next step of the process.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Let me just make a couple of points here. As the prosecution team pointed out in their presentation, the settlement has arisen from confidential settlement negotiations. And I think it's clear that neither party here is probably anxious to get into the strengths or weaknesses of their respective cases in a public forum while there's still potential risk for having this litigated in another public forum. So I think we need to give a fair amount or a healthy amount of deference to the parties and in the settlement that they've arrived at in their negotiations. I'd like to ask Stephanie to talk a little bit about the options the board has and the risks and benefits that may come from each of those options. So Stephanie, can you do that?
Sure. So the action before the board today is pretty limited to either approving the settlement as it's proposed. You cannot approve it. You could direct the prosecution team that you do want to have evidence and actually schedule an evidentiary hearing and litigate this. Or you can have them go back to the drawing board and renegotiate the terms of the settlement if it's still what they want to do. So, in terms of not approving it, one of the things that you could do, if there's a part of the SEP or something along those lines with which you are uncomfortable with, you can direct the parties to flesh out perhaps part of the things that make you uncomfortable. But the risk of rejecting this particular settlement today is that it sounds to me that it was a pretty elaborate and coordinated effort with other agencies. And the regional board may or may not have ready access to the evidence that would be needed to support their claims. And also that raises the expense and time of moving forward with an evidentiary hearing. So those are the things that are coming to mind right off the top of my head. I think certainly when you, if you were to send it back for renegotiation, things, the terms could change. Also with the litigation, the opportunity for having a SEP comes off the table. That's not something that's available if you decide to proceed with an enforcement hearing on this action.
Thanks, Stephanie. That's a good point about the SEP. I also wanted to point out that the SEP does address a high priority water quality issue in the region and is in alignment with the Water Board's mission with disadvantaged communities. It's also fully compliant with the SEP policy. So at this point, we're suggesting that the board do adopt this and approve this settlement. But if you have some more questions or other comments, now would be a good time to talk about it.
And I'll have a couple. One of them, again, as I reiterated a couple of times, I'm not opposed to the SEP and its fundamental value. If there was any tweaking, as I'll call it, so there is a better cohesive synergy associated with other constituents of poor water quality in these households, I think it makes sense. Very specifically, I believe that most of these 20 homes, if not all of them, are currently in exceedance of drinking water standard in terms of nitrate. They're over 10 ppm. So here we would have a bottled water program. Okay, we address one thing. Oh, and by the way, we're going to do this other thing with the TCP. That's not a holistic solution. So I think that, and this, by the way, the replacement bottled water is also handled by community, the community water center. So there seems to be a bit of a need to have these issues hand in hand. If I was a homeowner, I'd be totally confused. Like how many device are you going to have to provide me here? Because one, the TCP in this case will be addressed, for hygiene use as well. But the replacement bottled water address the nitrate. So I guess I'm still hung up on that. And that can be fixed. So I'm not saying that because of that, I would not be in favor of this settlement. But I think it needs a little more thinking through later on. I'm saying this sort of on a handshake, so to speak. The other issue, though, is still back to my colleagues, specifically Mike and Jeff. I'm still a little puzzled because I think there were significant economic benefits, and I would actually say there was a pattern of practice here. Hence, this was in many other locations, and there was a significant cost avoidance benefit because you take these repeated situations that have occurred over over quite a while. If you take a corporation cost of money, you're looking at 4 to 5% annual. That's significant, and that does not reflect in some of the
settlement calculation. So I guess I'm still, I want to hear a little more from my colleagues, but I'm still a little uneasy with that part on the value of the settlement. And I'll leave it as that. And I'm looking for my colleagues to raise their hands. Let's see.
Looks like yes. Jane.
Yes, Jane.
Yeah. So I share those concerns. It feels like the settlement isn't commensurate with the pattern and practice and the history that's chronicled in the staff report. However, I'm not sure I have, you know, all of the facts in front of me. And we've seemed to have had a pretty exhaustive discussion back and forth in terms of what we can access. I really don't want to take it any further. My preference would be to, you know, to accept the recommendation of staff and move forward and derive the benefit out of this project that we can. But I too am a little bit in the dark and the level of settlement that we are being offered here.
Yes, Mike.
Counselor, is it allowable for us to go into closed session to deliberate on this?
I don't think so, because we're not taking in any evidence. Our ability to go into closed session on an enforcement action is limited to deliberating on evidence.
Yeah, I asked that question before, but thank you for confirming. I'd like to get any more input from, you know,
Jeff has his hand up.
Okay, I was just going to ask you, to Jeff, if you had further comments.
Well, I'm kind of torn by this. It's very complicated. I mean, going through these calculation sheets is not easy. You got multiple facilities, multiple different kinds of violations, and I'm not opposed to what's in front of me. I think I could vote for it, but I do that with a little bit of reservation or hesitation in my mind that maybe the amount should be higher. And how much higher, I don't know. And I'm just kind of struggling with that. I do appreciate the fact that there have been multiple agencies involved in this. A lot of brain power has been put forward to trying to come to what's in front of us. And I think staff has done a pretty good job. You know, I give some deference to what they've done and in their opinion. So I don't know what else to say, Mike. I don't know what your thoughts are. You know, it's like, do we accept it and move on? Or do we want to open the Pandora's box to this? And that would certainly take a lot more time for us and staff, and it takes the step off the table. So, you know, if someone put a motion on the floor, you know, I think I would vote for it, but still with that hesitation in the back of my mind.
Thank you, Jeff.
Sorry, I can't be of more help.
Well, it's you're expressing your views, and I think that's important. Dr. Hunter?
Yeah, my comments fall in line. I'm very appreciative of the full suite of individuals who have had a role in this and can help parse some of the wheres and whys and hows for us. But I do understand that what's at stake if we decide to, as Mr. Young put it, open up Pandora's box. I think once I heard that the $15 million amount overall and how other agencies and other actions are occurring and our portion of that and our role, in responding to the situation. And I think in the long run, what I'm really interested in seeing is compliance going forward. And I heard from staff that the operator has made and is continuing to make improvements. And that goes a long way to my thinking that we've identified a significant problem, and we've had a good response from Monterey Mushroom, and I am inclined to support this. And perhaps the last thing to comment on is because this exceeded the number that is allowed by the for the executive officer to move on his own without getting board approval, we would not have seen this. So my comment, I guess, in the end is when it does come to the board, I think the board really wants to see more detail and have more insight into how the calculations and the assessments, for example, the comment that where it's intentional versus accidental violations factor in. And those kind of broader considerations are not always easy for us to see. So I do appreciate people coming forward who have those details and can, to the best they can within the limits that Stephanie has outlined, help us to get a better understanding. So perhaps in the future, we would be able to see a little more detail on this, maybe earlier in the process. I don't know. But anyway, I do support it today.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Hunter. And I, you know, and before, you know, Mike, you just raised your hand. I think, by the way, that this process we're taking is very important because is part of us, you know, vetting this. And I mean, we're talking about, again, significant amount of monies allocated for one single entity to manage a SEP. And, you know, we have to show due diligence of our efforts to vet this. So I think all these questions, although we may appear as, gee, we asked some details, I think that's part of our job. I just have one last clarification that I would appreciate. And maybe Harvey, you can answer this one, or you, Stephanie. Since the second primary environmental agency that was involved with this is California Fish and Wildlife, the site of the Regional Water Board, did they have any input on the settlement? And it's like, wow, you got, you know, I'll use one extreme saying, great job, you really showed due diligence in finding a party for what they caused to the environment, or did they view this, well, this is not in our wheelhouse, you guys work out the details? I mean, we relied heavily on fish and wildlife data to justify the damage done to the environment. That's where the information comes from. So I haven't heard anything about their input.
I can try to answer that question. Fish and Wildlife is an administrative agency. They do not have a board, and they do not have enforcement authority of themselves. So when they find a violation of the Fish and Game Code, like they did here, they count on either the AG or the district attorney to litigate that matter. So that's what's happened here, is that those DA cases all relied heavily, if not completely, on the evidence from Fish and Wildlife.
And hence, they do not offer opinions or input in the final process of the ACL or settlement.
I'm sure, well, go ahead, Stephanie.
Based on what I see in the materials, it doesn't look like it. You know, now whether or not there was discussion during the other proceedings or even maybe consultation, I don't know. But based on what I see, you know, this looks like it looks like a straight up water board determination and calculation of the penalty.
It seems to be a little odd because there are many situations where there are a violation of the California Fish and Wildlife Code where they are directly engaged in the process. I'll give you a simple example, illegal takes. That goes straight into their wheelhouse.
Yeah, so it looks like the Enforcement Council has something to say, so maybe I'll defer to him.
Yes. Thank you.
So this was a joint prosecution amongst the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the district attorney's office that represented that. And we, how can I put this? We were all, every agency or participant in any of the settlement actions that are related to Monterey mushrooms were in coordination and generally aware of all the expectations of settlement before those were offered or agreed upon by Monterey mushrooms. So there was a strong coordinated effort amongst the DA's office and Department of Fish and Wildlife and turning their internal counsel from OSPR. And they were, have been, and are aware of this proceeding and how we chose to resolve those.
All right, thank you for the clarification. And Mike, you had raised your hand.
Yeah, Paul, in reference to what you're just saying, so if I understand you correctly, this was a whole series of settlements that were essentially coordinated and kind of worked out as a package. Is that correct?
Yes. So these cases proceeded on a parallel track. So say, for example, if the AG's office was involved or and DFW went that route, we could have consolidated all these cases, but we decided from the outset that this was an administrative action from the Water Board, and we moved in parallel under a joint prosecution agreement. And yes, it was not only a case that was referred to us from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, but coordinated by DFW and the District Attorney's Office from day one to make sure the Water Boards had input and nobody was crossing paths or sending any mixed messages on what needed to be done at these facilities and what the appropriate resolution would be.
And so is this the last piece of the settlements, or is there more hanging out there?
This is the last settlement. The other three settlements have been adopted.
And does, if we choose to throw a monkey wrench in it and say, go litigate this, we want millions of dollars more, does this impact relationships with Fish and Wildlife, et cetera?
It calls for some speculation, but everyone, let's just put it this way, everyone was in agreement, everybody knew the numbers before they were provided, and had an influence on the resolutions that the other agencies sought when they saw what the Water Board was proposing.
Okay, yeah, I you know, I have the same reservations that I've heard from Jane and from Jeff and from Jean-Pierre in particular, but it sounds a little above my pay grade too, and so I'm willing to support it, I think.
All right.
No, so I'm willing to support it. I'll take away the I think.
Okay, so I'm looking if there is any further questions, comments from my fellow board members. And let's see, I'm looking at you, Jane. I'm looking at Monica, Jeff. So, all right. So I think at this time, our board had the opportunity to ask all the various questions and you know, and express their various levels of comfort, but it sounds like there's a willingness potentially to go forward with this. So I think this is probably an appropriate time, unless Stephanie, you think I need to follow an additional step, but you know, to bring this to a motion and to a vote, I think we have.
done a pretty good job in vetting this. Yes, Mike.
I move that that we adopt the proposed settlement agreement with the ministerial revisions that were presented to us earlier.
I'll second that.
Any further comments? And I don't, let's see, I don't see any. So I would like to put to a vote this ACL R3 2020-0048. So Tammy, roll call, please.
Dr. Wolf?
Yes.
Ms. Green?
Aye.
Dr. Hunter?
Aye.
Mr. Johnston?
Aye.
Mr. Young?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, everyone. And I can't see the pictures of the rest of the folks representing Monterey Mushroom, but I assume there are a lot of utter smiling faces right now, having this matter put to final resolution. And look forward also getting regular reports, and I'm addressing this to our executive officer, giving us updates on the next steps of this step here. So at this time, since we do not have item 14, I would like to promptly move to the item 15, which is the administrative items executive officer report. And the floor is yours, Matt.
Thank you, Chair Wolf. So the EO report for this meeting consists only of the standard tables that provide updates regarding our 401 water quality certification program, groundwater case closures, and general order or waiver enrollments. So you didn't get the typical EO write-up this time around, but I'll drum something up for you next time that's meaningful and informative. So we have staff available if you have any questions regarding the information provided in the tables associated with the executive officer's report.
Dr. Hunter.
Yeah, I just have one question on table four. What is the Main Street Middle School closure in Soledad? What does that involve?
Can answer that question. It's a closure of an underground storage tank case.
And what were they storing underground? What kind of, what's that?
If it's through the UST program, it's typically gasoline, diesel.
Not uncommon for some schools where they have their district maintenance facilities where they had historically either underground or above ground fuel storage tanks for their fleet vehicles.
So the implication is that they are co-located with their district maintenance. They have vehicles that are parked there and stored there and obviously are possibly fueled up for their run throughout their district. Okay.
Yeah. And it may not actually be co-located with the school itself. I'm not sure about this one, but there are some that are associated with the school, but they're a separate facility, and some were historically on the same property and were adjacent to each other.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, what we could do for fun is go to GeoTracker together and look at this case if you wish.
Well, thank you. I wouldn't mind seeing it. I just think it leaps out when you see a school for an underground tank. How that occurs, and if these are remnant of another era when these kinds of activities were not considered to be in conflict.
Could have been fueling buses too.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. the GeoTracker link in the table will take you directly to the case file for this site. And we have a case summary form at the very top usually of the site documents. And that describes all the specifics on the closure. Typically it is, they removed the UST, they're excavated the soils and then backfilled with clean soil. And then that's moving forward. That's how it gets closed. And that's all described in this case closure summary form.
Okay, very good. I'm looking at the hard copy, so I don't have the link open right now, but I will follow up on it. Thank you.
The link isn't working if you're looking real time. You okay. Can keep refreshing, but it's not loading.
Okay.
All right. Do you want me to send you the link, the active link, so you can look at it?
Yeah, sure. That would, if you can do that easily, it would save me some time in trying to peel through layers to find it.
Any opportunity I have for board members to browse around GeoTracker, I'm all for it.
Excellent. Thank you, Taya.
All right, that's your weekend assignment, Monica.
Well, I'm not issuing a report.
Darn.
Thank you.
All right, so I'm looking at Jane, Mike, Jeff, any further question for Matt? All right, I see none. So this then is the last item of the day, and this will conclude, unless any of my fellow board members any comments, which I don't see any. This will conclude our Friday, July 17, 2020, Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting, and it is just shy of noon. So thank you. Great job, everyone. And also a special thanks to our staff, State Board, and also the various parties who were online. We had 32 Zoom participants, most from California, and we had one from Washington and one from Maryland, by the way. So thank you. Have a great upcoming weekend, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Nice to see everyone. Bye.
Thanks for being here, Heather. Mm-hmm. See ya.